Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with Frank Wildhorn, a wonderful composer who has spent a lifetime creating the most amazing music, both for pop songs and for the Broadway stage. He is currently about to have three shows open on Broadway at the same time. Even for Frank, this is something of a record. So I'm going to play music from his very first show, Jekyll and Hyde, and also from, well, I want to say his most current show, Bonnie and Clyde, but I believe there's another one in the hopper and I don't have anything from Havana. So in any case, it's a glorious experience of wonderful music and a very, very interesting interview. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about understanding that most of us, dare I say all of us, come out of childhood believing and therefore acting as though we are less than we really are. We learn very early on what about us works in our family of origin and therefore in the world, and what doesn't work. And if there are things that don't work, if there are ways that we are or things that we say or do or ways in which we behave that bring criticism, embarrassment, even punishment, we learn very quickly to extinguish the response to be those things. But those things don't go away. I like to talk about them as going undercover, kind of like spies. And we create, like spies, a cover story. These are the things I am. This is my cover story. And it leaves out sometimes very significant things, things which actually later in life we really need. For example, if you were a basically very energetic child, you were frenetic, you were all over the place, you had all this wonderful energy, and you had a parent that was made uncomfortable or even scared by that energy, and that parent let you know in no uncertain terms that you were to sit still, you were to be quiet. You were maybe in the old-fashioned terms, you know, children seen, not heard. Well, you may have learned to diminish yourself, to whatever the opposite of expand is, contract yourself. But later in life, that energy might really serve you. So it is my belief, based on my more than 30 years as a psychotherapist, that those qualities which we had to deny as children don't go away. They go, as I said, undercover. And they are there to be recovered, discovered. And I talk in the shows about why this happens, why we do it, why it is useful to recover things we have hidden about ourselves and long ago forgot we had, and why that process, even when you have discovered what you've hidden, is sometimes problematic and sometimes even dangerous. I'm not going to talk much more about that in this show because I want to play not only the interview with Frank, but I think four different songs from different shows. So I don't want to take much more time, but if you're curious about this, you can find this information in previous podcasts on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And you can go up there, and there are blurbs saying what I'm talking about, and you can click on a podcast. Or you can just keep listening to the show, because sooner or later I'll get around to talking about that some more. But now I want to play a song from Bonnie and Clyde, which is about to go to Broadway. And this song is What Was Always Good Enough for You. It's sort of Bonnie and Clyde's anthem to their parents, explaining why they couldn't, however much they loved their families, follow in the footsteps of their respective father and mother. This is, of course, music by Frank Wildhorn, whose interview you will hear in a minute, and lyrics by Don Black. So here, from Bonnie and Clyde, and by the way, this is Jeremy Jordan as Clyde, and Laura Osnes as Bonnie. And if you were listening in the last few weeks, or if you go up on my website, you can hear the interviews I did with them. But now, just their glorious voices.
What was always good enough for you, Pa? Hate to say ain't good enough for me. Plowing fields and planting seeds till your mind and body bleeds. No way. Up before dawn and you stop when you drop. Then you ask your God to forgive. Praying for rain, without rain there's no crop. This ain't no way to live. What was always good enough for you, Pa, will not satisfy your wayward son. Jesse James had much more fun building dreams with just a gun. That's how West was won.
What was always good enough for you, Ma? Gotta say it good enough for me. Making punch and baking pies, painting barns and swatting flies. grab myself a beer and smoke a fat cigar. What was always good enough for you, Ma, will not satisfy your little girl. More to life than potting plants, I don't wanna miss my chance. I'm looking
This country's had its day. Depression and breadlines are all that tomorrow will bring.
Tell him, Clyde.
The Bible has got it wrong. Just look at the poor, poor, the meek. Don't inherit a thing. There ain't nothing good enough. We deserve all we are gonna get.
Want my jukebox to be crammed.
Want my silk shirts monogrammed. No more doors will be slammed. Should be notified. It'll be a bumpy ride. Thanks to Buddy and Clyde.
I wish I had more time to play more songs from Bonnie and Clyde. Not only so you could hear Frank's wonderful music, but so that you could hear Jeremy and Laura, more of Jeremy and Laura. But I do have four songs on my website from the show. So thelynshow.com, thelynneshow, if you want to hear them, please go up on my website, listen to the songs from Bonnie and Clyde, and also Laura and Jeremy's interview. And prepare to go to New York City to see Bonnie and Clyde open on Broadway next summer. But now I want to play a song from Victor Victoria. You will hear the story. Frank will tell the story of how he came to write this song, the 11th hour song for Julie Andrews in Victor Victoria. And I'm not going to tell you that story because he will. But this is the very first music he actually had on Broadway. Not the first show he wrote, but the first music he had on Broadway. And it's an amazingly propitious beginning. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. So this is Julie Andrews doing Living in the Shadows. Music by Frank Wildhorn. Lyrics by Leslie Berkus.
Living in the shadows, hiding from the sunlight, hiding from the one light that might help to guide you. Hiding from tomorrow, hiding from the day, only brings a sorrow that won't go away. Wandering in the darkness, living every midnight, doesn't ever rid night of nightmares as love might. Life is full of dangers, strangers every turn. Living in the shadows, there's no way to learn. The more you The more you care, the more the world is kind. One thing I can tell you, life should be your lover, help you to discover your reason for being. Soon you will be seeing what you're all about. Living in the shadows, you're
I'm going to play one more song before I play the interview with Frank. And this, as well as the last two songs I'm playing in the show, are all from his very first musical, Jekyll and Hyde. This is the first musical he wrote. It took a long time to get onto Broadway, and you will hear that story in a little while. And also the story about how he found the woman who's singing this song. And you will hear, when you hear this one, and I'm going to do one more with her, Linda Etter, that he and Leslie said, we want to write for that, and you will hear why when you hear this next song. Also, I want to say I have now heard, beside Julie Andrews, three of the female singers that Frank has wanted to write for. And he's got an ear for the most amazing female voices. And I think this was his first. At least this is the first one he talks about in the interview. And you will hear, like Laura, what an extraordinary voice this is. So this is Linda Etter from Jekyll and Hyde. This song is No One Knows Who I Am. Of course, everyone knows who she is now. Here, Linda Etter.
Look at me and tell me who I am.
Nobody
Well, okay, I'm here with Frank Wildhorn, who has rushed through dinner in order to do this interview with me. Thank you so much. Oh, my God. So I do an internet radio show, mm-hmm. and in it I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist. Mm-hmm. And I interview people who make their living or their life mm-hmm. with an art.
Right.
And clearly,
cool.
Yeah.
Do I do that?
Yeah, do you do that?
Well, it's working.
Yeah, right. And given what we've been talking about, I mean, it's like you don't only do you have your living and your life, you have virtually every second of your life with your art.
But I'm not a workaholic at all.
No.
I you know, I'm very good with my time. You know, I think I learned that making records and being a pop writer, you know, in the 80s and 90s where you're doing so many different things at once because that's the nature of that beast. Theater tends to be more, you know, you concentrate on one and the other. But I'm kind of an exception to that rule because I still have that pop mentality, which is to do a whole bunch at the same time.
At the same time.
I just do. But I have plenty of free time to play.
That's wonderful. And so the art to mm-hmm. which you have given your life is music.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So I always ask people the same question. Mm-hmm. How did it happen? How did it find you? How did you find it?
It found me. It definitely found me.
Tell me.
I was born in Harlem and grew up in New York City. But my parents moved down to Hollywood, Florida. I'm a Florida boy.
Really?
Yeah.
When did you move? How old?
When I was 14.
Oh, so what you had?
73.
So you had 14 years in New York City and then Florida. Wow, what a change.
And I loved Florida.
Yeah.
I have great memories of Florida, and I loved growing up there, kind of near the water.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Hollywood Hills High School, where I was playing football. I was working for the city of both Hollywood and Fort Lauderdale as a lifeguard. And life was pretty kind of easy, you know, in the 70s. and what happened, the long story short, was... in the summer of my 14th, 15th year, I taught myself how to play.
Piano?
First organ.
Because organ?
There was one in the house.
You had an organ in your house?
Yeah, my mom always played the piano, and my sister wanted to play the organ, so we had one, and I was fooling around with it, and then I went over to the piano.
Well, wait a minute. You were fooling around with the organ?
Yeah.
This is a boy who's playing football and is lifeguarding, and you're fooling around with the organ?
I know, how weird is that?
It is weird.
Do
you know why?
No.
Did it call you? Did you see? You happened to be passing it, and you said, "Let me see." I mean, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it was not an intellectual thing.
No, it was a gut thing, right? Visceral thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and that's kind of how I write, by the way, and that's who I am. So, it kind of makes sense to me. But it was very soon that my hands hit the keyboards that I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew I was making music.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe I can make music. And that's yet another way to meet girls, you know.
All of these things are good ways to meet girls. Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Especially, you know, you're a teenager in Hollywood, Florida, in the 70s.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Right.
So, but it really took no time at all for the music to take over my life.
So now, were you a teen, the kind of teenager who had the equivalent of what would have been a boombox at the time? And did you collect records and all that?
I always loved music, and my parents always had tons of music in the house, and very eclectic, you know, everything from, you know, Tchaikovsky to Elvis, from Sinatra to the Beatles, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I thank them for that, for just, you know, having such an umbrella of so many different colors, you know.
So did you study?
No, I taught myself, and what I did, which is what I still do in my life, I surround myself with musicians who know more than I do.
Wow.
And I've never, when you say, do I study, I don't think I've ever stopped studying. I think, you know, to be a student of something mm-hmm. is important all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you be a student of music and of life.
So how did you find musicians at 14 to...
Friends of brothers, you know, guys I played ball with who had brothers or sisters who played. And the specific story is a guy who I knew in high school, his brother went to Berklee School of Music in Boston, and there was a teacher there named John Mohegan. And he created a series of books on improv and harmony and theory and all this. And he gave me the books. The kid gave me the books and said, you know, you should read them because then at least you'll know what it is that your hands are doing.
What you're doing, right.
So, you know, I learned the difference between a C6th and a C16th, or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And how to change voicings of chords and make them different things. So I could look in the book and read what it was I was doing and then go from there. But I just started playing, and, you know, 3 weeks later I talked my folks into giving me some money so I can buy a Farfisa organ. and played my first gig at 15, 16 at the Diplomat Hotel.
You're kidding.
It was a Sweet 16.
On your own, or you played in a band?
With a band, with a band.
You played with a band in Dallas?
And I had a band, and then the next thing I know, I had another band, and another band, and I had a famous band.
So you were playing, you were learning single songs, or you...
Yeah, I was learning top 40, you know,
yeah,
stuff,
right.
Everything from the Stones to the Doobie Brothers, from
right,
Stevie Wonder
right,
to
right,
Marvin Gaye, and...
Right.
And this was, we're talking like 74, 75. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in there, then I had my own band called Sunrise Highway, which was very successful mm-hmm. in Florida, 76, 77, somewhere in there. And I kind of took it as far as I could take it, you know, to this place.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of knew there was more, you know, and so I...
Well, what was the place to which you took it? Are you saying you had as many gigs as you could get? You were working as much as you could work, and that was it.
At that time, in the 70s in Florida, was a great time to be a live musician on both coasts,
wow.
You know, especially, you know, from the Castaways and mm-hmm. and Marco Polo and Fountain Blue in Miami up to... Through Fort Lauderdale and Bachelor's 3 and Brick House and the Playpen and... It was wonderful places to play.
In a way, it was kind of what the Catskills has been.
Absolutely,
right.
A little bit.
Right.
It was a great place. And then, you know, what happened was is some of the guys that were in my band had fathers who were musicians.
Uh-huh.
And they became huge influences on me. And they were the ones, especially there was a guy named Eddie Mena, great sax player, reed player, and his father who passed. His name was Julie Mena, and he had a music store, Mena's Music, in Hollywood, Florida. And he was a singer and also played reeds, and he was a big influence on me. He was like the one that said, you know, listen, you've got something here, and don't let anyone tell you you don't.
Wow.
And, you know, and I would always say, yeah, but, you know, my folks think I need a safety net. And he said, no, you don't need a net, because if you do, you'll use it.
Nah.
If you don't have a net, you can't fail. There's no option. I remember that like it was yesterday.
What an interesting thing to tell a kid. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
How old were you in there?
15, 16 years old, somewhere
right.
in there. Julie Mena, I owe him a lot. And like I said, I'm a Florida boy, and so all that influence there was big. And that was, you know, it was also the Bee Gees were down there, and Casey and the Sunshine Band, and mm-hmm. a lot of great R&B was being done down there, and, you know, acts were coming in and out, and I would go to the concerts and stuff. And I played in jazz bands and cover bands and any place you could play, you know, I was playing. And like I said...
So do you read?
A little bit. You know, I read chords and melody and stuff. But I could pick up things.
Yeah.
And I was always writing. I always was doing enough of my own original stuff. And kind of one thing led to another. The band was doing good. But I knew I had to go somewhere. And it was really at that time...
You know, a lot of people wouldn't have known... A lot of people would have thought, whoa, this is terrific. This is enough. Do you know why you knew you needed to go somewhere?
Yeah, my appetites are pretty big. And I can't wake up unless I have a mountain to climb. So, you know, I felt like I did a lot of research. You know, where is it happening? Where is the cool stuff coming out? And in the late 70s, it really was either New York or mostly L.A.
L.A., I know.
And the L.A. was the publishing business.
I know.
So I went to USC. I went to University of Southern California. I was a history major.
Really?
And a philosophy minor. And there was a great old actor at USC at the time named John Houseman. Remember John Houseman?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, he befriended me. We had a very strange, wonderful relationship. And I started writing shows there, and he would produce them, direct some of them.
You're kidding.
Yeah. And some of the people who were in my shows have gone on to some pretty amazing stuff.
When you say started writing shows, you mean you started writing the music for them, or you started writing the book lyrics?
There was a show I wrote in 1978-79 at USC called Christopher. It was like Jesus Christ Superstar Part 8 from a Zen Buddhist point of view, because that's what you're into at 19 years old. And the guy who played the lead was this tall, good-looking guy at USC named Chuck Wagner, who went from there to playing Into the Woods, the Prince Charming in Sondheim's Into the Woods. And the girl who was the lead in that show, her name was Madeline Smith, a beautiful brunette, and she was plucked out of the show to play John Travolta's girlfriend in Urban Cowboy and started a movie career. And we all were in that one show.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting time. And then what happened was, as I thought would, is in the late 70s, early 80s, is the publishing business, the music publishing business. And I can't sing, so I knew I wasn't going to be a singer.
Oh, because it was all singer-songwriters then?
Yeah, well, no, it wasn't. But I just knew that that's not... I knew I had to write for singers. And I also knew the publishing business was out there. And what happened was is the people from the publishing businesses would come to my shows at USC, and they would say, you know, you have a flair for melody, or you have a flair for accessible pop stuff. Why are you doing this theater stuff? You're only going to get your heart broken. Nobody makes any money. And you know, there's no theater in L.A. So I got offered my first publishing deal, you know. And so ATV Music, Sam Trust ran it. And I started doing demos with some amazing collaborators, you know, in the, now we're talking the early 80s.
So now are you writing music and lyrics?
I'm writing music and lyrics, but with the kind of collaborators I was meeting, I was writing a lot just music. You know, I was meeting a lot of great lyricists. And I started demoing my songs and writing, and thank God people started recording them. And then from the early 80s through the early 90s, I had, you know, over 1,000 records recorded, and songs, and we probably sold 60, 70 million records.
My goodness.
And
yet again, you thought there's got to be more than this.
Yeah, well, because I love doing the, you know, I get bored really quick with everything. And I found that writing one or two songs for an artist was cool and, you know, could make a lot of money. And in the case of Whitney Houston, I wrote Where Do Broken Hearts Go? So that kind of changed my life in a lot of ways and bought me the financial freedom to take care of, you know, people around me and then spend the time getting my heart broken in theater for a while. But, so the pop business was a great teaching ground for me.
Another teaching ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you'd wake up in the morning and your publisher would say, all right, you're going to go write for Stacey Lattisaw, a 16-year-old African-American girl, you know.
Right.
And then tonight you're going to meet with Kenny Rogers and his people and you're going to do that.
Yeah, right.
So you're always every day challenged to write from other people's points of view.
That's
and
wonderful.
It was great training for theater, which is so ironic because the theater always looks down on the pop thing. And yet the pop thing was, for me, the best training ground for theater.
Sure, because you're writing for character.
Yeah.
Right.
But I never lost the love of putting those shows on at USC. And what happened was, by the end of the 80s, the early 90s, the pop music business was really starting to change.
Yeah.
It was much more singer-songwriters or band-oriented music, where the record companies were signing less singers that didn't write their own stuff.
Right.
And they were signing people who they could own the songs and the band at the same time. And black music, where I made a great deal of my living, really had changed, you know, between hip-hop and rap and stuff like that. And they didn't need, you know, the Jewish kid from New York to write those songs anymore. So what happened was, is, you know, a lot of my collaborators back then, the ones who were so wealthy, kind of went into semi-retirement and lived off of their huge royalties. Some of them moved to Nashville because Nashville was and still is a place where, you know, you could just be a writer. And stuff. Though the sales aren't what they, of course, used to be, so it's not like
no,
it was.
No, the whole music business has changed anyway, right.
But, and then there was me, and I said, you know what, I think if I can do theater the way I want to do it, which is to do it with a pop sensibility and make it accessible and not apologize for doing that, you know, I'd love to do that. And a few things happened in the late 80s for me at the same time. One was I met a man named Leslie Brickus, and he came into my life and kind of is both like a friend slash father to me.
Wow.
And I've learned more from him about life than I have about music. He's the greatest man. He's my hero. And he took me under his wing, and we started writing Jekyll and Hyde together.
Oh, my God.
So that happened. And then also in the late 80s, there's this TV show called Star Search.
Mm-hmm.
And so this girl named Linda Etter started winning Star Search.
Yeah.
She's a really tall, beautiful girl from Minnesota. And Leslie and I heard her and said, well, we need to write for that, you know. And so we started writing Jekyll and Hyde, kind of the female parts for her. And then in 89, I met a guy named Gregory Boyd, director who runs the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas. And he really took me under his wing. And in his first season there, in a theater that had never done a musical, 89-90, he did Jekyll and Hyde.
Wow.
And it was my first professional experience, and it was Linda's first professional experience, and he let me use all my guys who I was making pop music with in L.A. to come down to Houston to make the show. And, you know, Leslie was kind of godfathering us, you know, because he had the experience. And the experience of doing it was so romantic and so sexy and so full of challenges.
And compelling.
And how can we do it? And compelling and profound. That it was that experience that said, you know what?
I got to do this.
I got to do this. Mm-hmm. Because I was making a hell of a lot more money doing pop music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And, you know, the critics in pop music don't really matter. You know what I mean? You just there's too much stuff out there.
Right.
You know, if the people like it and the record company supports it, it happens. So, but the experience of Jekyll and Hyde changed my life. That's why we're here. That's why we're talking.
Well, you know, what I hear is that not what changes your life is there's a series of people who come in at just the right moment.
Yeah.
Always older men, essentially, and they mentor you, they find you, they say, you, I'll take you, you know, and you know, that's not...
I'm very lucky. Believe me, I know how lucky.
Yeah, it's an interesting pattern. I mean, it's not common.
Yeah, my first partner writing pop music was an older guy, an English guy named Brian Potter, who wrote Ain't No Woman Like the One I Got.
Oh, my.
And Don't Pull Your Love Out on Me, Baby.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm.
And One Tin Soldier Rides Away, and tons of hits. And he totally mentored me. And then years later, John Houseman, you know, at the college.
That's right.
Brian Potter there, and then Leslie Bricus later.
Well, and the saxophone player's father at the beginning.
Julie Maynard, absolutely. You know.
Right.
So I had these guys that kind of, you know, said, go.
You know, this is not that common.
Right.
I mean, this is almost, you know what Bachert is?
Bachert, yes, yeah. I do know.
That's what it feels like. You know, it feels
Yeah.
It feels like, you know, this. You were meant to do this.
Right.
And so somebody was going to come along at every appropriate moment and point the way and help. And
you're right.
It's very lovely.
Yeah, no, it is.
What are you thinking?
No, it is. And because I do the same thing now.
I was just going to ask
so
that question.
For so many people, for, you know, giving people their breaks and... And doing all that kind of stuff. So.
I was just going to ask that if you.
Yeah, I love doing that. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's very important to me, and it's joyful to me. Is what it really.
Yeah,
is.
Yeah, well, you give it back, right?
Yeah.
Give it back. Maybe because you. I mean, clearly, it's your own talent and your own passion and your own commitment and your own energy and all that stuff that's made you successful. I mean, that's nobody can give you that, but there are a lot of people with talent and. The universe does not conspire to...
No question. You know, the more I'm around, the more I see, you know, how many talented people are, who are not going to make it and who wake up in the morning and shoot themselves at both feet. And,
right.
You know, you always like to hope that real talent will shine at the end, but it's got to have opportunities to do so, and then...
And maybe, you know, some are meant and some are not.
Maybe. Kismet. Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. So.
So then I started my crazy theater adventure, and then while I was working on Jekyll and Hyde, which of course was the main goal to get Jekyll and Hyde to Broadway, and at that time I also started running a division of Atlantic Records, which I did for 12 years.
Oh my!
Atlantic Theater, which I started and did, and you know I was kind of the American who was doing concept recordings of my shows before they came out. Jekyll had a couple, Scarlet Pimpernel, Civil War, all had these big records out because I was from the record business.
That's right.
So, I was successful enough in the business to get opportunities to create these records, not because the record companies love theater. In fact, it's quite the opposite was true. Theater is kind of the depth of selling real numbers. But they thought my music was so accessible and commercial that
they thought it could sell.
They couldn't say no.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, and Linda, who was became the, my really my voice, you know, we were married for 17 years. I signed her to Atlantic Records, and she really became like the ambassador of the music of Jekyll and Hyde through the concerts and the records and stuff like that. And, you know, you just kind of pushed the boulder up the mountain. You know, it took a few years. But then we did the national tour in 95, 96. And then we reached Broadway finally in 97, 17 years after I started writing it at USC, you know, so it took that long. But also what happened was a year before that, I got a call one day. Because of Leslie, I got to meet some amazing people.
No kidding.
You know, all the time. And I became very friendly with Henry Mancini, who really liked my work. And of course, Leslie wrote Victor Victoria with him. And he was ill. But they were doing it on the stage. And through a series of of conversations and introductions, I met and befriended Julie Andrews. And when Henry couldn't write anymore, she had heard the Jekyll and Hyde music, and she had heard what I was writing for Linda. And so she asked me if I would finish the score.
Wow.
So even though Jekyll and Hyde was my first show, and my show, my real first experience on Broadway, was writing for her, for Victor Victoria, which was... I mean,
my God.
What can I tell you?
Right.
It was everything you think it was.
Yeah, right.
It's amazing. She's an amazing broad.
Yeah.
That's what she is. And it was great. And then Jekyll, and then Pimpernel, and Civil War, and the next thing you know, 60 Minutes was at the house. So it was quite a run there, you know. And then Dracula after that. And then I really started, I started looking at theater, you know, not just as 14 blocks in New York, but the world. And there's a man named Freddie Gershon, who's another huge influence on my life.
They just keep coming.
He owns a company called MTI, mm-hmm. Music Theater International. And in some ways, I guess he's the most powerful man in theater in the world because he owns the second-class rights to everything from West Side Story to Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow.
From Les Miserables to everything Disney does, from Sondheim's catalog to...
Because everybody wants to be out there.
Well, the thing is, you can't do one of their shows unless he lets you. Around the world. He's the one who licenses it. But we had a relationship that was way beyond business. It was really...
Right?
Yeah, I called him Uncle Freddie. And he said, Frank, you know, be the only young American to go around the world and go to these opening nights of Jekyll and meet these producers and see what's going on. And that started a whole nother adventure for me, which was this kind of international thing. I mean, I have many shows right now in Japan and South Korea and in most big cities in Europe, and Freddie opened all those doors and really made that happen. And I write shows for those areas that are not for Broadway. They're literally for that. So...
Now, are you saying you write the music or you write the shows?
No, the music. Mm-hmm. I put the teams together.
Right,
so
right.
In Prague is the third year of My Carmen is playing there right now, and in Switzerland is Monte Cristo, and opening next year in Madrid is Cyrano. But these are shows that, whether they come to Broadway or not, are not important.
No, it's not what it's about.
It's I'm writing for those theaters and for those producers.
And yet again, it's that writing for the character. Writing for the, right?
Yes, always, always. And I have like a scenario in Asia. I have a lot of shows in Japan and South Korea where we're there a lot. And now we kind of, now it's kind of come back circle again. So as we're talking today, Wonderland, Bonnie and Clyde, Havana, the revival of Jekyll, which we have a deal to bring. So the next few years is kind of back to Broadway, the next chapter.
Yeah.
So it's fun.
It's wonderful.
And Atlantic Records is no more. I'm not with them anymore. They were a part of Time Warner. And when Time Warner and AOL merged, and then it was a giant catastrophe.
Yes.
Time Warner sold all their music interests. And so Atlantic was part of that. It was so incredibly sad, given that it was Time
and
Warner.
And dumb. They bought AOL and they sold Atlantic.
Right.
Never mind.
But so now I'm with Sony. I have a deal. I have my own label on Sony. And the crazy thing is Linda and I, who hadn't worked together for many years, just finished our first record together.
Oh, my God.
Last week. Yeah. That I just delivered before I came down here for rehearsals for Wonderland. So it just, it continues, and we have as much fun as we can.
And you're not done, so I imagine there are mountains still to climb.
I hope so. My God, if there aren't, why wake up,
Yeah. It's interesting that you said you're not a workaholic and that you find time to not work.
Yeah.
But... I mean, I'm listening, and I can't imagine where that time is.
No, it is. Pamela and I share a great life, and I have my two kids, and I have a horse farm upstate New York, and we have plenty of fun and plenty of time to do all kind of wonderful things.
Well,
because you have to put back in the well, otherwise there's nothing to write. You know what I mean?
I understand.
So, Leslie taught me that. He always said, Frank, you work hard every day and you put out and then I figure out a way to put back in. So I try to follow his advice.
It's lovely. So the other question I ask is, having dedicated a life, as you clearly have, to the creation of music, what would you say about it?
What would I say about it?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I'm doing a show called Wonderland, and I do a lot of speeches these days you know, to either raise money or create awareness. And I didn't make it up. I start every speech by saying, this is my life.
Yeah.
My life is Wonderland. You know, it's kind of wacky and romantic and sexy and fun and
everything wonderful. You wanted it to be.
And yeah. And much more. Who and knew back then? You know, I didn't know.
When you started playing in the organ.
No idea.
No. It's lovely. I think that's a good place to stop.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So there you have it. A man who absolutely knows who he is. And who is who he is. And, you know, if you've been listening to the show, you know that the reason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art is because in order to make a living or a life with an art in our culture, it has to be who you really are. And when you listen to men and women who make their living with music, with dance, with fine art, with sculpture, well, any art at all, you know you are listening to someone who is, at least in the area of their work, demonstrating who they really are, who has a kind of congruence between what they demonstrate, how they are in the world, and who they really are, someone who is in sync with themselves. And Frank Wildhorn is someone who is very definitely in sync with himself, and you hear it. It's in every syllable. It's in his tone of voice. It's in his delivery, and it is definitely in the way he chooses to live his life and what he chooses to do with it. And if you've been listening to the show, you know this is the reason that I interview people like Frank, who make their living or their life within art, so that you can hear what it sounds like when a person is congruent, in sync with themselves. There's no disconnect here between who he thinks he is and who he's demonstrating and who he is, at least in this area, in the area of his work life. And of course, it is my hope, as always, that when you hear it, it's inspiring. Inspiring everyone who listens to look into their very heart and see if there's some part of themselves which they have been denying, something they suspect that they could do or be or think or feel or express, which you may not have yet had an opportunity to. So I don't have much more time to talk about that in this show. I will continue to talk about it in the shows in the future. And of course, again, you can find this information on my website, again, thelinshow.com. But now, in the event that you think Frank can only write for extraordinary female voices, I'm going to play This Is the Moment, the high point of Jekyll and Hyde. Extraordinary tune for this extraordinary male voice. And then we're going to go out on another song by Linda Eder, just because it's such an amazing voice and such a beautiful song. But now, This Is the Moment from Jekyll and Hyde, sung by Bob Cuccioli.
This is the moment, this is the day, when I send all my doubts and demons on their way. Every endeavor I have made ever is coming into play, is here and now, today. This is the moment, this is the time, when the momentum and the moment are in rhyme. Give me this moment, this precious chance. I'll gather up my past and make some sense at last. This is the moment when all I've done, all of the dreaming and scheming and screaming become one. This is the day. See it sparkle and shine. When all I've lived for becomes
for a moment. This was the moment, the greatest moment of them all.
So doesn't that make you want to run right out and see the show? Or at the very least, get the cast album, which is, of course, what I did. Okay. We're rapidly closing in on what's left of this show. So before I end the show, I need to do what I always do, which is thank Josh Hackney, without whom, I'll tell you, I am not really computer literate or recording literate or any of that. I learn these things and I do them, but when there's the slightest glitch, I am completely thrown for a loop, and I run immediately to the phone or the email or however I can get in touch with him and scream help to Josh. And Josh comes riding to the rescue in one way or another. And so I always want to say, if you need any help at all with any of these things, electronics, recording, computer, website, internet, any of that stuff, you want Josh Hackney. And you can get him by going to my website, again, thelinshow.com, where you can get all those other things I told you about. And just email me and say, I want Josh, and I will get it for you, or I will get him in touch with you. And so, as always, I am hoping that you heard something you could use in this show. And if not something that you can use in your life, something that just made your life better, because there was so much wonderful music in this show. I'm hoping that whatever it is you heard in this show is going to bring you back, because, as always, next week, same time, same station, I will be here. And I hope you will be, too. And we're going to go out on another song from Jekyll and Hyde, music by Frank Wildhorn, lyrics by Leslie Brickus. And this one is Someone Like You, the beautiful voice of Linda Eder.
I peer through windows, watch life go by, dream of tomorrow, and wonder. The past is holding me, keeping life at bay. I wander lost in yesterday, wanting to fly, but scared to try. But if found someone like me, then suddenly nothing would ever be the same. My heart would take wing, and I feel so alive if someone like you found. See a world I've never seen before. Allow to open every door to set me free, so I can soar. If someone like you found someone like me, then found me, oh, if
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go.